Today at Reader's Corner, Dr. Leonard Sachs, author of The Collapse of Parenting, How We Hurt Our Kids When We Treat Them Like Grown-Ups. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. As anyone with children knows, parenting isn't easy. The next generation is growing up in a complex and connected world where smartphones, video games, organized activities, and friends vie for their attention. At the same time, parents aren't exactly always sure what their job description should be or how best to nurture their child. In his book, The Collapse of Parenting, Leonard Sachs presents a compelling case for why parents should remain front and center in the lives of their children and teens, rather than allowing peer relations, the internet, or other distractions to take precedence. Parents need to serve as authoritative guides for their children if they are to learn the values and habits that will enable them to become fulfilled adults, Dr. Sachs says. And he decries what he calls a growing culture of disrespect that leaves parents powerless and the kids in charge. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Dr. Sachs. He is a longtime practicing physician and psychologist and the author of several previous books. In The Collapse of Parenting, Leonard Sachs describes the problems that arise when we treat our kids as grown-ups and offers concrete examples on course corrections parents can make. Dr. Sachs joins us by phone for this interview. Leonard Sachs, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks for inviting me.
Could we start with your background? Now, I've already stated, of course, that you're a practicing physician and psychologist, but you've had quite a journey getting to where you are in the publication of this book. I'm talking about the perspective and the expertise you gathered internationally before you put pen to ink here.
Well, I've been a medical doctor for 30 years and never set out to write this sort of thing, but in the course of my 30 years of being a medical doctor, I've seen some really big changes. Recently a mom brought her daughter in to see me. Daughter had a fever and a sore throat. And I said, I looked at the ears, they were fine. And I said, okay, next we're going to look at the throat and do a strep test. But before I could do that, mom said, is it okay if the doctor looks at your throat and then afterward we'll go for ice cream? And the daughter, who was six years old, looks at mom and thinks this over and says, no, I don't think so. And what should have been a 10-second procedure becomes a 5-minute ordeal requiring an assistant to restrain the child, who is now screaming and furious because she was offered a choice. And she made a choice and her choice is being disregarded. And mom thinks she's doing the right thing because she read somewhere that you should always let kids decide. And in some settings, maybe that's true. Like, what would you rather have tonight, green peas or lima beans? But if you have a fever and a sore throat and you're in the doctor's office, you're going to get a strep test. And by presenting this as a choice, mom isn't making things better. She's making it worse. And this has become very common, this confusion among parents.
Is this common just in America, or is this common elsewhere where you've traveled? Because I know you've spent time in Australia and other parts of the world talking to school administrators, talking to parents. So what did you learn about comparisons and contrast to this issue of moms and dads, you might say, abdicating their parental authority?
Yeah, I share a story about that in the book. I talk about how I was leading a workshop at a school named Shore, which is in Sydney, Australia. And I've visited more than 40 schools across Australia. And I was starting this workshop, as I do very often in the United States, talking about motivation and creating a kind of an esprit de corps in the classroom. And I said, look, even in the most elite schools, there's always going to be one or two kids who are going to disrespect you, who are going to try and take you down. And one of the teachers, his name was Cameron Patterson, he raised his hand. He said, Dr. Sachs, I have no idea what you're talking about. And I don't think anyone else here knows what you're talking about either. We never encounter this. And I said to the other teachers, is that true? Is Mr. Patterson, who agree? I said, let's see a show of hands. Who agrees with Mr. Patterson? All the hands went up. Who disagrees with Mr. Patterson? No hands. At that school, they do not encounter this disrespect, which we in the United States now take for granted, that in a class of 20 or 30 kids, you're always going to have one or two who's going to make farting noises or in some other way disrespect the teacher. But at this school, they don't. In fact, they said it is the rule. It is not a written rule, but it is a very common thing that at the end of the class, each student will greet the teacher and thank the teacher and say, "Great lesson, ma'am," or "Great lesson, sir." That would be really unusual in the United States. So yeah, there are significant variations in this phenomenon. And I certainly think the United States is an outlier in that what I call the culture of disrespect.
This abdication of parental authority or the transfer of authority from parents to kids, how did that happen? What is it about our history or our culture that caused this to come about?
Well, it's a good question, and I try to explore that, although that's not a major focus of the book. So the question of why this happened is secondary. And I think it happened because of the way that political culture infiltrated the family. The last 50 years in the United States have been all about empowering the disempowered. And so women gained equal rights, and that's a good thing. People of color gained equal rights, and that's a good thing. And hierarchies in the workplace were, in many cases, not all, deconstructed. And that's probably a good thing. And so for a parent to say, why do you have to eat your vegetables before dessert? Because I'm your mother and I told you so, now seems old-fashioned. The problem with empowering everybody is that the relation between parent and child is not analogous to the relationship between adults in the workplace. In the workplace, I think everyone should have equal rights and nobody should be privileged over anyone else. And we should all respect one another equally and defer to one another equally. But kids are not born knowing right and wrong. They have to be taught. And teaching right and wrong requires authority. And in my 30 years as a medical doctor, I have seen this change. 20 or 30 years ago, parents would say things like, "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you." But that command has morphed into a question. The question being something like, "Well, how would you feel if someone did that to you?" And the parent doesn't know what to say when her son says, "If someone did that to me, I'd kick him in the nuts and then I'd sit on his face." Teaching right and wrong requires authority. And parents need that authority, but parents have, in many cases, abdicated that authority. And the result is that kids look to the marketplace. They look to the internet. They look to social media. And what they find there is Justin Bieber, Miley Cyrus, Kim Kardashian, Nicki Minaj. And those are not good role models.
I think at one point in your book, you make the claim that parents of days of old at least could count on schools and communities to back them up, to perhaps provide some of this authority that you claim is now missing in the household. And yet that's changed a lot, too. I couldn't help but notice the Arkansas report. I don't know whether you saw the case of the parents who went to take their kids to this all-boys private school in Little Rock. And there was a sign up in front, and it said, "If you are dropping off your son's lunch, books, homework, equipment, etc., please turn around and exit the building. Your son will learn to problem solve in your absence." I thought I was reading your book when I saw that in the Washington Post, and I thought, I have a feeling Dr. Sachs would really like that sign.
Well, I understand where they're coming from, because indeed many parents act as though their job is to make their child's life as easy as possible. I've heard the phrase lawnmower parents, meaning that the parent goes before the child like a lawnmower and smooths everything out. Very few parents will admit that this is their parenting style, because when you put it out that way, parents will at least pay lip service to the idea that, no, you know, you should let kids try and fail and work out the consequences of their failure. But in the book, I'm actually focusing more on the moral issues. And not because I'm preaching a sermon. But because there's over 400 scholarly references in the book, and quite a few are devoted to the question of what should we be doing as parents? What should our top priority be? And again, this is not a sermon and it's not a guess. We have good research to answer that question, where researchers have followed kids from childhood through adolescence into adulthood. And so we can now ask the question, what parameter, what characteristic measured at 9 or 12 years of age best predicts health, wealth, and happiness in that individual 20 or 25 years down the road? Researchers followed the same cohort for 20, 25, in one case, 38 years. So I'll pose this question when I meet with parents. Is it grades? Is it test scores? Is it a combined measure of grades and test scores? Is it personal appearance? Is it how friendly you are? Is it how many friends you have? Is it openness to new ideas? Or is it virtue and character? And the answer, of course, is virtue and character and self-control predict health and wealth and happiness far better than grades, test scores, IQ, or any of the other measures that I mentioned. So it follows, logically, that our first priority should be to teach virtue, character, and self-control, because they are very teachable. And again, a big chunk of the book is devoted to how to teach them. Many parents will give lip service to that. Oh, yes, we believe in the importance of character. But when you look at what parents are actually doing, they act as though what really matters is getting the best possible grade in every course. And not surprisingly, there has been an explosion in cheating among American kids. American kids are cheating much more than they were doing 20 years ago. We have good data on this, which I cite. And the character of the cheating has changed. 20 years ago, it was the kids at the lower end of the academic spectrum who were cheating. Today, that is not at all true. If anything, it's kids at the very top who are now maybe more likely to cheat, because the moral guidelines have been pushed aside. And instead, parents are saying, hey, you want to get into a highly selective college? You got to get great grades, great test scores. And kids are getting this message. So getting back to your point about the alliance, the breaking of the alliance between parents and students, I've been a medical doctor for 30 years. And I can tell you that 30 years ago, 20 years ago, if a kid got in trouble at school, he'd probably get in more trouble at home, because the teacher would call the parents and the parents would enforce punishment more severe very often than what the school was doing. But today, if a kid gets in trouble at school, very often now, parents will swoop in like attorneys, demanding evidence and mounting a defense. The alliance between parents and school has been broken in many communities across this country.
So if you remove the parent as the authority figure in the family, who takes his place?
You have to worship someone, as the old saying goes. And that vacuum is filled by social media and the internet. Kids look to one another. They look to Instagram, and they look to the internet. And again, as I said a moment ago, what they find there is Eminem and Akon and 50 Cent. And what they're learning there is that what really matters, what's most important in life, is being famous, being wealthy, and having a million followers on Instagram. And that's not a good message. It's not a healthy message. And again, this is not a guess. We have very good evidence that the more time a kid spends on social media, the more likely that kid is to become anxious and or depressed. And I cite those studies in the book.
I suppose you're really leaving it up to the kids' peers to come up with the values it takes to lead a good life. And that's not going to work very well, I assume.
And again, we have very good data on this from longitudinal cohort studies. You don't have to guess or conjecture. For example, we have studies where researchers looked at kids 9, 12, 14 years of age and looked at how the kids entered the household to evaluate how are the kids interacting with the parents. And they find that if the parents are authoritative, meaning that they set down rules and enforce them in a loving way, that 10 years down the road, those kids are much less likely to be addicted to drugs or alcohol, much less likely to be anxious or depressed than the kids in the home next door, identical demographics. But those parents are letting the kids sit in their room with a screen And if it feels good, do it. And the 14-year-old boy is spending hours a day looking at pornography, and the 14-year-old girl is spending hours a day uploading her photos to social media. And what you find is that a few years down the road, and it doesn't take long, that boy with the more permissive parents, that girl with the more permissive parents is much more likely to be anxious or depressed. Kids need parents to be parents. Again, this is not a joke. Why is childhood so long in our species? Look, in chapter one, I compare humans with horses. A horse is full grown by 4 years of age, and a horse is a bigger animal than a human. A four-year-old human is just getting started. Why? Why is childhood so long in our species? So much longer than any other species, actually. Well, researchers, again, have investigated this. We don't have to guess. And the answer researchers come up with is to teach culture. Childhood is many years duration in our species because it takes many years for parents to teach. That is the job of the parent, to teach the culture of that parent to the child. And American parents, in many cases, have stepped back and abdicated that. They don't understand the role. But kids will acquire a culture. That is the function of childhood. And if you do not teach them your culture, they will, as I've said several times now, look to the internet and they will adopt the culture that they see there, the culture of Miley Cyrus and Eminem and Justin Timberlake, a culture that's all about glitz and appearance and surface, and which leads to anxiety and depression. Again, these are not guesses. We have very good research on each of these points, which I present in the book.
You write at length about fragility, which sounds very much related to what you're talking about here. I assume an outcome of this ineffective parenting? Fragility in young people?
It absolutely is. Look, again, Professor Coleman at Johns Hopkins 50 years ago went across the United States interviewing teenagers, and he asked them a number of questions, one of which was, if all of your friends wanted you to join a particular club, but one of your parents did not approve, would you still join? And 50 years ago, the majority of American teens said no, they would not join, because the good opinion of their parents mattered more than the combined opinion of all their peers. I posed a similar question to kids at many venues across the United States between 2008 and 2015. I asked them, if all of your friends wanted you to join a particular social media site, would you consult your parents before joining? And the most common answer I get from American kids is laughter. As one girl said, why would I ask my parents? She said, they probably think Ask FM is some kind of radio station, you know? They're clueless. Parents used to matter more than same-age peers. Parents today matter less than same-age peers. And that leads to fragility. Why? Look, if my daughter were to say to me, I hate you. I'm never going to talk to you ever again. Get out of my life. You know, there would be some consequences. She would lose some privileges, I'm sure. Her mother and I would discuss and decide what the consequences would be. But you know what? Nothing fundamental would change. She would still be my daughter. She would know I still love her. She would still have her place in this house. But now suppose she says those same words to a same age peer. I hate you. I never want to talk to you ever again. Get out of my life. That friendship is over, or at very least, it is seriously damaged, and it may or may not be capable of repair. Same age peer relations are contingent and ephemeral, and every kid knows it. And that's why you see all these checking their phone every 5 minutes. God forbid your friend sends you a text message and you don't promptly answer it. She might think you're ignoring her. She might think you don't like her anymore. And you can go from being the most popular girl to being the odd girl out in one day, in 1 hour. Same age peer relations are contingent and ephemeral. They can fall apart in a day and every kid knows it. And so the least little thing can tip these kids over. They are very fragile because what matters to them more than anything else is what their peers think, and kids are kids. They can be cruel, they can be vindictive, they can be mean. If you are not grounded in your relationship with your parents, if your parents don't matter more than kids, as they ought to, and as they have in almost every culture of which we have any enduring record, then you will be fragile.
And you discussed this term fragility in relation to an increase in the proportion of young Americans who are diagnosed and treated for anxiety and depression. And, of course, that leads to another central message of your book, which is, why are so many kids on medication? And help us understand what's going on in the schools.
And that's where we, the United States, are really an outlier. A kid in the United States is 14 times more likely to be on medication for ADD compared to a kid in the United Kingdom. A kid in the United States is 40 times more likely to be diagnosed with bipolar disorder compared to a kid in Germany. A kid in the United States is 93 times more likely to be on medications like Risperdal and Zyprexa compared to kids in Italy. You asked what happens when parents step back from authority. And one thing that happens is that the doctor steps into that vacuum and prescription medication takes the place of parenting. And the same parent who is horrified by my suggestion that supper at home with the family should be more important than a play date with friends is the same parent who is medicating their child with one, two, or three psychiatric medications. We Americans now use medication as a first resort for any kid who has any kind of problem. That's weird. It's dangerous. It is unprecedented. That is one domain in which the United States is now truly unique. There is no other country on the planet where medication is the first resort for a kid with problems. But in the United States, it now is.
You stress conscientiousness and self-control as perhaps the most important traits to instill in a child. Help us understand that.
Well, again, the basis for that recommendation is those longitudinal cohort studies that found that self-control and other measures of virtue and conscientiousness are the best predictors of health, wealth, and happiness long-term. And parents will say, well, how do I teach my kid self-control? My kid is not self-controlled. And I explained that, look, self-control is not hardwired. You can change it. How do you change it? Parents will ask. I say, look, if your kid's 8 years old, you change it by saying no dessert until you eat your vegetables. No screen time until you do your homework and your chores. And the same goes for the older kid. No Instagram until your homework's done and your chores are done. And parents will say, oh my gosh, I couldn't do that. And I'd say, that just would never fly. I say, look, your next door neighbor is doing it. You can do this. And again, a big objective of the book is to empower parents, to encourage parents so that they can make a change. And I tell parents, don't try to be subtle and don't try to be cute. Sit down with your child and say, look, we've been doing some things wrong. We're going to make some changes here. No more screens at the dinner table. I'm not going to be looking at my phone and you're not going to be looking at your device at the dinner table. When we're at the table, we're going to listen to one another. When we're in the car, no more earbuds in the car. When we're in the car, I'm going to listen to you and you're going to listen to me. When we go on vacations, when we go to the ski resort, no, you are not allowed to bring your best friend along. Because if you bring your best friend along, it's you and your best friend going up on the chairlift, and all I've done is pay for a very expensive play date. The point of the vacation is to reconnect parent and child. And when you say these things, your child may not be pleased. They may not applaud. When you tell your daughter, no more cell phone in the bedroom. When you go to bed at 9 o'clock, I'm collecting the phone, I'm turning it off, and I'm putting in the charger, which stays in the parents' bedroom. You can have it back tomorrow morning. And your daughter will not be pleased. And she may complain very loudly. But it's your job. What's your daughter supposed to say tomorrow in school when her friend says, hey, I texted you last night at midnight. How come you didn't answer? What's your daughter supposed to say? She's supposed to say, well, studies have shown that having a cell phone in the bedroom diminishes sleep quality in adolescents. You know, it's ridiculous. You have to allow her to say, hey, my evil parents take my phone every night at 9. They won't let me have it back till the next morning. This is your job as a parent. And the first week after you have this conversation may be a challenge, and your child may be upset with you. But you know what? After 6 weeks, you'll see a change, and your child will be happier, and you will be happier.
So let's look at the other side of the coin. Why is how parents give praise to their kids so important?
Well, I think it's important. You know, a lot of people, when they hear that my book is about parental authority, they think it's about discipline. And in fact, it's not. It's about the character of the relationship between parent and child. And I've got a whole chapter titled Enjoy. And what I mean by that is you got to enjoy the time you spend with your child, which seems trivial and cliched, but it is not. We actually have some good studies where researchers compared American parents, especially American mothers, with mothers in France, and they found that mothers in this country enjoy the time with a kid much less than mothers in France. That mothers in this country are often overwhelmed and feel they don't have time, and they're juggling three different things, really is a challenge to put aside the multitasking. And, you know, when I'm with my daughter, I'd like to go outside, so I'm not tempted to look at the phone or the screen, so that we can just have time together. As soon as I get off the phone, actually, we're going to the water park for just that reason. And it is a discipline, and you have to make time for it. You have to put it on the calendar, and you should be praising your child much more than you are criticizing your child.
I don't know how many times I've heard folks either complain about or joke about the fact that when little kids get involved in activities, especially sporting activities, Little League or whatever it is, every kid walks away with a trophy. And it reminds me of one of your lessons you leave us with toward the end of your book, why teaching your kids humility is so important. Could you talk about that for a second?
Yes. So I mentioned before that the studies show that teaching virtue is the most important thing you need to do as a parent. Well, which virtue? And I argue, and I try to present the evidence, that humility should be the first and most fundamental virtue that American parents try to teach. Why? Because it is the most un-American of virtues, because being awesome is now the American commandment. Everyone's supposed to be totally awesome. And the problem with that, I was in a classroom, third grade classroom, where every kid was required to write their name and to write next to their name on this big piece of paper five adjectives about how amazing they were. And so this one boy had written awesome, a genius, misspelled, excellent, misspelled, and so forth. I'm not mocking him. He's doing the assignment. But in this country, we indoctrinate kids in their own awesomeness with no awareness of how that leads to resentment down the road. I have seen certainly quite a few kids who at 14, 15, 16 were told how amazing they were. And then 10 years down the road, this same girl who at 15 was told that she was amazing, had a spark of the divine fire, one of her teachers told her. 10 years down the road, she's written two novels, can't get an agent, and she's seething with resentment as she's watching the Today Show and hears some other young woman who's written a novel, and she's on the Today Show, and this woman is saying, I can't even get an agent, and my novel is better than hers. The culture of awesomeness, of bloated self-esteem, leads to resentment. The culture of humility leads to contentment and happiness. It's not a guess. We've got very good research supporting that. And it's a challenge in this country to teach it, because the culture of Instagram and social media is all about, look at me, look how amazing I am, look how many followers I have. It's not easy to go against that culture, but you can do it. You don't have to move to New Zealand. Moving to New Zealand is one option, but it's not required.
Well, Dr. Sachs, our culture and those who shape it have lots of work to do. Again, thanks to you for your book, The Collapse of Parenting, How We Hurt Our Kids When We Treat Them Like Grown-Ups. Thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks again for having me on.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Leonard Sachs. Next week, Franz De Waal, author of Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Deborah Palmer. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. To sign up for our free email podcast, visit our website at boisestatepublicradio.org and search for Reader's Corner. We'll send you an email each week with a link to the latest show.